You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we take a look at Wisconsin Biographies, a PBS Wisconsin tool that helps kids learn about Wisconsinites who made history. Now, as the nation marks Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day, there are lots of questions and debates in the political world about the best ways to teach the history of race, racism, and the civil rights movement in American schools. In the last couple years, a wave of anti-racism protests and efforts like the 1619 Project called for more attention to that history and to the long-term impacts of racism. That was met by a backlash centering around a concept called critical race theory. And Republicans in state legislatures in Wisconsin and around the country worked on laws to change the school curriculum and define what teachers could and couldn't say about race and history. A Wisconsin historian joins us now for a look at the question, how should we teach kids about race and American history? You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your answer to that question. If you're a parent of kids, what kind of things do you want to see them learning at school? If you're a current or former educator, what did you find difficult or maybe fulfilling about teaching students about the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King Jr.? What kind of responses do you get from students, their parents, from your community? What thoughts do you have about bills which don't mention critical race theory by name, but say they target it? You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Robert S. Smith is the Harry G. John Professor of History and Director of the Center for Urban Research, Teaching, and Outreach at Marquette University. He's the author of the book Black Liberation from Reconstruction to Black Lives Matter, which came out last summer. Rob, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Glad to be here this afternoon, especially today. Thank you for the invitation.
Well, it's not always easy to talk about race and racism, even among adults. When it comes to schools, what are some of your baselines for the way we should think about how to teach kids about race, racism, and American history?
Well, you know, it's probably the hardest topic to discuss in a number of ways. I think the first thing we have to do is always, and I'm going to borrow from Marquette University's mission, we have to be in search of truth. That's what has to guide all of what we do with any educational approach, but particularly with history. And in that process, there are certainly debates that can help inform and help us approach truth. And so you get multiple perspectives, you get various approaches, and then there is indeed this important process of rigor that it gets us to some understanding of historical truth, and that can still be debated in all kinds of ways. And so it's the discourse that we have to be committed to first and foremost. But I do think when we talk K-12, we have to think about the age of young people. We have to think about what we should teach young people so that they can best absorb some of the complicated and difficult topics. We have to be committed to it over years and build upon ideas and topics in our school curricula. And in that process, then for the more challenging and difficult and indeed violent portions of our history, we have to make sure that we have a full contextualization of the individuals involved so that we humanize everybody who's involved in those historical dramas, and then also continually make sure we're paying attention to policy and law and all those other components to help us understand that. I know I just dropped a lot in that, which probably made folks go to sleep, but you asked a history professor a question like that.
And I asked you a big, broad question, too. Now, where things seem to get a political response these days is when we say, we're looking at this part of our history and connecting the dots today and saying we're still feeling the impacts of slavery through segregation, through voting rights, property rights, that sort of thing in 2022. What do you think about teaching that connects the dots between our history when it comes to race and racism and our current state of racial relations?
Well, in some cases you can connect particular dots. And, you know, for example, housing and home ownership is one of those histories that the dots get connected very easily in a lot of respects. In other capacities, in other arenas, you might see a history echo more than have a direct connection. You know, voting rights has some very connect ties to it. We've worked much harder as a nation to deny large numbers of people the right to vote than we have worked to include more people in that process. And yet there are also these ways, and so those are some direct examples, but in terms of the echoing, you see the ways that disparities in any number of arenas continue. We see moments of progress in some ways during key reform eras. And as you mentioned, we then see backlashes and retrenchment. And so that's where the echoing becomes a useful way to think about it, because you don't necessarily have to have these direct connections all the time, but you do need to have a sense of where you've been in the past, what looks familiar from some of those previous developments, because that then gives us a sense of how we get out of these situations, and that indeed we can get out of them in some way if we're creative about the ways that we engage people and voice and policy.
Talking to Robert S. Smith, historian at Marquette University, looking at how we teach about race, racism, and the civil rights movement in U.S. schools. You can join in with your thoughts or your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. You pointed us toward a speech, the Drum Major Instinct speech from February of 1968. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. here, talking about conversations he had with the white wardens of the jail where he was held in Birmingham.
And I said, you are put in the position of supporting your oppressor, because through prejudice and blindness, you fail to see that the same forces that oppress Negroes in American society oppress poor white people. And all you are living on is the satisfaction of your skin being white and the drum major instinct of thinking that you are somebody big because you're white. And you're so poor you can't send your children to school. You ought to be out here marching with every one of us every time we have a march.
There's a lot of Dr. Martin Luther King's speaking to talk about. Why did you point this one out to us in particular?
Well, you know, there are a couple of, I think, important components about this. This is just a couple of months before we lose Dr. King. And it provides this window into, toward the end of this speech. And I encourage everybody listening to go revisit the Drum Major Instinct today. It's a brilliant, brilliant conversation that Dr. King is having from his position as a leader of a movement, the face and voice of a movement, but then also his role as clergy. But then that very serious and very real journey we all go through, and that's determining what our life legacy will look like. What is it that we leave when we are no longer here? And he's grappling with those very serious questions. And at the same time, it highlights and emphasizes again how brilliant of an intellectual Dr. King was, because using that drum major instinct idea, he then critiques not only the individual self, but he looks at race prejudice, as we heard in that particular clip. He looks at U.S. global politics in this same lecture. And then, it's a rich engagement with him as a person, a human being, a leader of this important reform era in U.S. history, and then also this astute intellectual as well.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Sarah is with us in Libertyville, Illinois. Sarah, hi.
Hi there. Well, I've done this with so many classes, but the one that I guess I'll talk about is second grade, a dual language class, and we would have like a week-long unit on civil rights. And of course, we had to simplify it a lot, so it was mostly Rosa Parks and segregation, and then we would talk about Martin Luther King and the Voting Rights Act, like very, very simplified, but that how he was able to get that passed. And my kids just love it. They always love it. And they're so shocked to find out that segregation exists and that there were all these obstacles to voting. And then when we talk about these people standing up and being courageous and working to change it, they clap. I mean, these kids get really excited about it. And I had one girl who was she just started jumping up and down and cheering and like clapping. She was just so happy.
Sarah, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Sounds like Sarah must be a good, enthusiastic teacher there for one thing. Rob, what do you think of her shocked and inspired her students are?
Well, thanks Sarah, because the work that our teachers are doing, and have always done, but particularly in this moment, we need to all take a moment and thank them seriously over and over and over. So much of the experience with young people, educators witness that moment that a young person's face sort of changes when you know that they've engaged in a topic that's impacting them. It's one of the beautiful moments of being an educator. And that's sort of the gold nuggets of it all. But these are brilliant stories. You know, these are heroes. These are mothers and fathers and sons and daughters and uncles and aunts. They're folks who we walk past every day who've done some remarkable things. The average person has been more central to social change than the leaders themselves. You know, the leaders are important for carrying messages, but it's the day-to-day stories of folks overcoming and doing heroic and remarkable stuff that is so inspiring. And it's important for our young people to hear that so that they know that indeed they are the agents of the future. You know, it's their future that we are in some ways helping to mold, but they are really responsible for that. And it's important, as Dr. King said in the speech, that we all be drum majors for justice, you know, and what better way to do and highlight those important stories, to tell those stories and to encourage young people to be drum majors for justice, but from Dr. Rosa Parks and these other legends.
Thanks for that call, Sarah. We're talking to Robert S. Smith, professor of history and director of the Center for Urban Research, teaching and outreach at Marquette University, looking at how we teach and talk about race, racism, and the civil rights movement in U.S. schools. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a parent, have you talked with your kid or kids about what they learn in school about the civil rights movement? What do you think about what your school teaches, how they teach it? If you are a teacher, love to hear your experience as well at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Marquette history professor Robert S. Smith, looking at the ways we teach about race and racism in American schools. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Will is with us in Eau Claire. Will, hi.
Hi, guys. Thank you for the show. And I wanted to ask your guest about other voices, men and women from that period, who he would identify as contemporaries of Dr. King. For example, I had the privilege of a group of us had a conversation and coffee with Andrew Young during, I think it was 1969. So just a quick question about other voices, men and women who were also pivotal during that period. Thanks so much.
Well, thanks for the call, Rob. I've heard concerns sometimes that we might get this picture that it was just Dr. King and the civil rights movement. And clearly, as Will was pointing out, it wasn't just him.
Yeah, thanks. Well, that's a great question. And I want to one more time just reemphasize that it's all those faces in those marches whose names we don't know, or whose names we may not know in that particular image or something, that those are the folks whose stories are so brilliant as well. And let's always remember those what we might refer to as grassroots activists who carried those local movements. There are two names that really come to mind that I think are important in this particular moment, and then also folks whose lives and whose ideas have been critical. And that's Bayard Rustin and Ella Baker. And so to my fellow educators out there, these are two folks who are so critical to longstanding movements for racial equality, but then also have inroads and ties and are involved in other struggles, whether it's broadly class-based labor movements, then also movements for gender equality. And so I'd encourage Bayard Rustin and Ella Baker as two key voices that deserve a bit more attention in the classroom. And they are also very complex figures as individuals. And so they provide some room for some other important discussions that are not directly movement related, but certainly play a role in some important topics of the era.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Rob, I wanted to look at laws being advanced or passed in states around the country, including one effort to pass one in Wisconsin that specify the curriculum and what is okay and not okay. The author of one here in Wisconsin wrote in a memo that the bill doesn't restrict teaching an inquiry about the history of racism, but, quoting, it restricts indoctrination, abusive pedagogies, and state-sanctioned racism, end quote. And then the supporting memo says red flag phrases include things like racial prejudice. What do you think, as you look at bills from state lawmakers trying to, I guess, change the way we teach about race and racism?
Yeah, it's disturbing that questions around education and curriculum related matters isn't engaged. This legislative movement, this backlash, if you will, this counter movement, that we don't have the voices of teachers and principals and curricular experts leading the way to move us forward in the classroom. The fact that this is being legislated is the exact reason why we have to explore these topics on and on and on, because these policies feel more like an effort to dismiss the past than to use the past, engage with the past, and become better informed about the past so that our learning today moves forward in effective and progressive ways. And so they're very disturbing. It's also disturbing that in our case in particular, here in Wisconsin, that the legislation encourages lawsuits to be directed at educators and school boards, that, you know, because that just creates more social division. It creates what's already a heavily and hotly, viciously politicized world. It just creates more and more division in our country and at our local levels. These are very problematic and very concerning, because you have experts in the classroom who can give us all the direction we need to make sure that we're teaching our young people appropriately. And to use these kinds of dog whistles, really, it's another echoing of a similar kind of playbook when intellectual thought, when creative thought, when critical thought is under attack.
Let's go back to our callers now. Joe is with us in Jefferson. Joe, hi.
Hi. So glad you're talking about this today. I've found for years, speaking with people, mostly white people in suburban areas and whatnot, that they tend to feel like racism is not a problem anymore, and that actually black people use it as an excuse. And this is such a prevalent thing, I think we don't ever talk about it, unfortunately, because it's such a sensitive topic. But when you're calling out, basically, like I am now, how much racism is around, you know, white people in general, that's a hot, how do you discuss this issue? And that's why with children, what I was saying to the screener is with education, you can get to the children, but I'm mostly talking about people that are older, obviously. And it's sad that, you know, I don't know how we're going to get to those people that are older. They're in denial and they rewrite history. And this is such a political, I think it's underneath the politics a lot more than people realize.
Joe, thanks a lot for the call. Rob, I know we're focusing on schools here, but do you have thoughts on about having productive conversations among grownups that don't just end in yelling and tears?
Yeah, you know, part of the speech there that Dr. King offered in that clip in particular, just before it, you know, he says that when he was, you know, in jail, he had very calm conversations with the correction officers there about issues associated with race. And that's in 1968. We've obviously devolved significantly, because we are in a place where it's very difficult to have any meaningful civil exchange these days. And yet it's great to hear somebody who sounds still willing to have those conversations. So all is not lost. I do want to add that, you know, our education institutions, the educational system more broadly, is the key place where we do have these conversations. And so it's important for us to preserve the richness that we can experience in our education system as a result of an exchange of ideas. And so let's make sure we remember how important our schools and our universities and our colleges are to that project. But I will say that living here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and working with a whole range of community-based organizations and community experts, they are always having conversations that help to raise our collective social IQ on a number of topics. And so I want to make sure to give those hardworking folks a shout out, because they are indeed a part of an important process of public education that's not in our schools, that's outside in our community spaces, in our libraries, in our museums and all these wonderful institutions that continue to push forward the importance of learning, public learning in those spaces as well.
In our last minute and a half or so, I know there are concerns on every Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day that people worry that we're getting a sanitized version of him. The I Have a Dream speech, the more unifying messages. What do you recommend to get a fuller, rounder understanding of his message?
You know, in some ways, I think that's the case. And I want to say something that could obviously be challenged. It's okay to go back over some of those wonderful stories, even if those are stories that we've heard over and over. There is an importance that goes into making sure that we know some of these key elements. At the very same time, we live in this digitally sophisticated world, and as you all know, in preparation for our conversation, we could share all kinds of information with one another, whether it's actual audio clips of Dr. King, the actual transcripts from his speeches, and you can find these at any number of institutions, particularly. Work that's been recognized by the family and archives recognized by the King family. So there's a wide array of ways to get to some of the other components to Dr. King that help to tell a fuller story about him as a person, him as a leader, him as a leader in the religious community as well.
Rob, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
That's Robert S. Smith, the Harry G. John Professor of History and Director of the Center for Urban Research, Teaching, and Outreach at Marquette University. We talked to him today, this afternoon, about some of the challenges educators face when they're teaching about race, racism, and the civil rights movement in American history, and how that work could be limited by bills in the state legislature in Wisconsin and around the country. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, it is this week's edition of Ask a Contractor. On the table this week, plumbing and electrical problems on the agenda. Don't work on them both at the same time, though. Call in with your questions and solutions related to your wiring and your plumbing. Maybe you have an idea, a solution you figured out yourself. Find out more, get your questions answered. Ask a Contractor tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. I've heard on the show from a bunch of experts the last couple months that we should up our mask game. If we're wearing masks, we need to go with things like the KN94 or N95 or whatnot. I even talked to a guy called the mask nerd. So I decided, okay, I'm in. I got some new masks. It's mostly going well, but I've learned two lessons. One, I have a large face. I mean, I kind of knew that already, but the whole trying out mask project really hammers that home. Two, the cheaper, flimsier kind of masks could go in the back pocket of my jeans, and they'd stay there. These new guys, not so much. I'm already down two masks to mysterious leaps out of my pocket, plus some more near misses. If you want some mask advice, search WPR Mask Nerd on a browser near you, and maybe don't keep them in your back pocket. Mask news you can use. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, the Associated Press recently investigated all possible cases of voter fraud in the 2020 election over six battleground states, including Wisconsin. We'll talk to one of the reporters behind the investigation about what they found. Now, a series of videos from PBS Wisconsin showcases the legacies of Wisconsinites who made history. There's Millie Zantow, who helped bring plastic recycling to the United States, Mildred Fish Harnack, who stole Nazi secrets during World War II, and many more. Mia Forsland is a coordinating producer for PBS Wisconsin Education, who played a big part in putting Wisconsin biographies together. Mia, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can you tell us, Mia, a bit about the history of Wisconsin biographies and some of the recent updates you've made to it?
Absolutely. So Wisconsin Biographies is a collection from PBS Wisconsin Education that is made for grades 3 through 6 and shares, as you said, the stories of people who have shaped Wisconsin's history. And the collection launched almost 10 years ago. And since its first launch, we've continued to add stories to the collection and are currently working on more stories to add.
And what kind of things can, say, a teacher go to and then end up using in a classroom?
As part of the collection, they can find animated videos, also biography books, which we have now added per page audio to, as well as historical image galleries. And then for them as educators, we have some helpful resources, including guides and a quick start chart to help them navigate the collection.
Let's take a listen to one of the videos with the Wisconsin biography about Vel Phillips, Father James Grappi, and their work to end housing discrimination against Black Milwaukeeans.
The Black community was hurting. Something had to give. Two people bravely stepped up to lead the way. Vel Phillips and Father James Grappi were an unlikely pair of heroes. Vel's story is a tale of firsts. She became the first African-American woman to become a Milwaukee alderwoman and to introduce a fair housing law.
Listen, I just didn't see why I should not be able to live anywhere in the city that I could afford to live.
James Grappi put himself through seminary school driving buses. While few others bothered to listen to the troubles of the inner core, this bus driver lent an ear.
Just one sample from Wisconsin Biographies. Mia, could you tell us a little more about the cause and the story you tell in this video?
You know, that story is one where Vel Phillips and Father James Grappi were very involved in their communities and were hearing about the discrimination that was taking place and decided to take action and rallied their communities around them and took steps with marching through the streets as well as proposing legislation to make those changes happen and ultimately were successful in having official recognition of the unfair housing discrimination that was taking place and brought their community together in the process.
Here's another sample. Joe B. Xiong was a Hmong American who came to the U.S. as a refugee from Laos and went on to be a pillar of the community in Eau Claire.
Joe B. was civic-minded. I always felt that I could make a difference and help people have their voices heard. He did just that beginning in Laos when he aided his fellow villagers in escaping communist control, and then again here in Wisconsin, protecting and serving as a police officer, a social worker, and the director at the city's Hmong Mutual Assistance Association. My father was also the first Hmong American elected to the Eau Claire City Council, or actually to any elected office in the entire state.
Mia, can you talk about the range of stories you tell? You cover a lot of ground geographically, socially, and even through time.
Absolutely. So our collection currently includes 16 stories, but again, it's growing. And these stories come from before Wisconsin was a state all the way through to, current times. While these people who are no longer with us, their impacts definitely live on. And some of the ways they've shaped our stories and our lives today have to do with the ways our communities are set up, some of the steps we've taken to protect the environment, ways that we have fought for people's rights, and also just so many things to think about in how we experience our everyday.
You reached out, I understand, to teachers and others in the education world to find out how they use this tool. What kind of things did you hear from them?
We heard so many great things that, they were using them in a lot of exciting projects with students in their classrooms. But again, since this collection has been online for quite some time, we heard from them, too, about opportunities to better meet the needs of their students by adding audio to the books, by thinking about how do we offer really robust educator support materials that can help them when they have limited time but really want to bring these resources into their classrooms. Also just, little things that happen behind the scenes, and we're able to add captions and transcripts in Spanish language to support those multilingual learners throughout our education communities, as well as being able to really just dig into the books and ensure that they meet a wide variety of reading levels.
If teachers or parents, for that matter, are interested, where should they go to find these Wisconsin biographies and all the supporting material?
They should check out pbswisconsineducation.org/biographies, and they will find the full collection there.
Mia, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Mia Forsland is a coordinating producer for PBS Wisconsin Education. She talked to us about the PBS Wisconsin project, Wisconsin Biographies. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary-Kate McCoy to tell us about a rivalry between the popular advice columnists Ann Landers and Abigail Van Buren.
Legendary advice columnist Ann Landers and Abigail Van Buren dished out wise and witty advice to millions of readers for more than half a century. The two were also twins and sometimes bitter rivals. But before they were famous, they lived in Eau Claire, Wisconsin for more than a decade. Dean Robbins brings you the story of the sisters who perhaps could have used some advice themselves.
Ann Landers and Abigail Van Buren were America's leading advice columnists from the 1950s into the 21st century. Dear Abby was the world's most widely syndicated newspaper column with 110 million readers. Ask Ann Landers wasn't far behind with 90 million. Each writer solved other people's problems, answering letters with homespun wisdom. However, their own problems with each other proved harder to solve. Anne and Abby became bitter professional rivals, but once upon a time, they were inseparable twin sisters, raising families a mile away from each other in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Born Pauline and Eppie Friedman in Sioux City, Iowa in 1918, they grew up doing everything together. They even had a double wedding in identical dresses and veils. In the 1940s, the twins moved to Eau Claire, where both of their husbands had jobs at the National Presto Appliance Company. Pauline and Eppie cut glamorous figures in their new community. They hosted elaborate parties, volunteered for local charities, and led parades in a Cadillac convertible. They also loved to watch the Eau Claire Bears baseball team at Carson Park, turning heads with their lacquered hairstyles. But by the end of their decade in Eau Claire, cracks appeared in the sisters' relationship. Pauline and her millionaire husband lived in a stately two-story, while Eppie and her poorer husband had a small two-bedroom that Pauline dubbed Peanut Place. They even began trading insults about each other's daughters. The stage was set for a blow-up, and it happened shortly after the twins left Eau Claire in 1954. First, Eppie took over the Ann Landers advice column at the Chicago Sun-Times. A mere 3 months later, Pauline jumped into the advice biz herself, starting Dear Abby under the pen name Abigail Van Buren at the San Francisco Chronicle. Eppie saw it as a hostile gesture, and the sisters stopped speaking. In 1958, a Life magazine article gave them a national platform for their quarrel. She wanted to be the first violin in the school orchestra, Pauline sneered, but I was. Eppie retorted, she's just like a kid who beats a dog until somebody looks and then starts petting it. Ouch. The magazine declared it the most feverish female feud since Elizabeth sent Mary, Queen of Scots, to the chopping block. The dueling advice columnists reconciled in 1964, but hard feelings remained. In a 1979 TV appearance, Eppie claimed she never read Dear Abby. In a magazine interview 2 years later, Pauline mocked Eppie as envious and inferior. For good measure, she said her twin looked old. Ouch again. Eppie died in 2002 and Pauline in 2013, concluding the saga of Ann Landers versus Abigail Van Buren. You have to wonder if, at the end of their lives, they pined for the innocent pleasures of Eau Claire. Yes, both had become wildly successful since their time in Wisconsin, hailed as America's most influential women. But would they have traded all that to be back in Carson Park, arm in arm, blissfully cheering the Bears baseball team?
Dean Robbins is a journalist and author based in Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary-Kate McCoy.
Coming up, we'll take a closer look at the AP's review of every case of reported potential voter fraud in the 2020 election across six battleground states, and we'll find out what the findings showed up here in Wisconsin. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. The Ideas Network has special programming tonight for Martin Luther King Jr. Day. At 8 o'clock, join us for a special MLK Day edition of Why Race Matters. Angela Fitzgerald of PBS Wisconsin's Wisconsin Life is your host. Find out more at WPR.org. Now, the Associated Press recently released an investigation into possible instances of voter fraud in the 2020 election. They looked at cases in six battleground states, including Wisconsin. They found that across all six states, the number of reported possible voter fraud cases amounted to less than 0.5% of the votes President Joe Biden won by. The findings come as former President Trump continues to repeat false and unsupported claims that the 2020 election was rigged. Christina Cassidy was the lead reporter on the AP investigation. She focuses on voting, election administration, and efforts to secure U.S. elections. Christina, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first, can you tell us how you and the team went about investigating these cases in six states?
Sure. So we started by basically hearing what everyone heard after the 2020 election, which was concerns that there was widespread voter fraud. So we decided to launch this project to find the voter fraud from the 2020 election. So we focused on, as you mentioned, the six key states: Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. And I, along with reporters in those states, contacted local election officials to talk to them about what they had identified in terms of their processes post-election for any suspicious activity, any potential cases of voter fraud. And as you noted, we found at the time it was fewer than 475 cases of potential voter fraud across those six states.
And I want to break that down a little more. In many cases, if I'm reading you right, those votes didn't actually end up happening or getting counted, right?
Correct. Because of the various processes in place in local election offices across the country, voter fraud, while it occurs, is generally detected and remains exceptionally rare. And that's because of those processes that are in place at the local level where, you know, for instance, you know, mail ballots, those are logged every time a mail ballot is requested or sent, and that's assigned to a specific voter. And so when that ballot comes back in, it is similarly logged. In a number of states, there are voter signature reviews that are conducted. And through this process, oftentimes any potential double voting, multiple ballots, this is identified through the process, and those double votes are prevented from occurring in the first place.
When it comes to the partisan side of this, I know probably we don't know which candidate many of these voters intended to vote for. Of those that we do, what did you see? What was the split?
Well, certainly voter fraud, as much of society, is bipartisan. It occurred by Democratic voters and Republican voters. In fact, there was one gentleman in Wisconsin who we had interviewed and spoke with who was on parole and didn't know that he was not eligible to vote. And he told us all he wanted to do was to vote for President Trump. And so he says that he asked if he could vote, and it ended up that, you know, as you know, Wisconsin is not one of those states that have loosened rules surrounding felons being eligible to vote. And so he was not supposed to vote, in fact.
And that highlights another piece of the story here. In some of these cases, the story isn't someone who says, I'm going to go do voter fraud. It's I got the voter rules wrong and accidentally did some voter fraud. Is that a fairly common story out of the 400 and some cases you looked at?
Absolutely. We found a number of instances that were administrative errors where, you know, the election officials had made a mistake, had made it, you know, appear that, you know, maybe there had been a potential fraud, but in fact, there wasn't. There were mistakes as well. But then, of course, there were also, you know, people who appeared to take intentional action to commit voter fraud.
We're talking to Christina Cassidy, reporter for the Associated Press state government team, looking at an AP investigation in six battleground states, including Wisconsin, looking back at the 2020 election, finding relatively very few cases of voter fraud. They looked at what led to those reported cases. Christina, I think someone who's worried about voter fraud might say, well, those are the ones that were detected. How do we know that there's not lots of undetected voter fraud slipping through?
Well, that goes back to what we were speaking about just a few moments ago in terms of the various protocols and procedures that are in place in local election offices all across the country. So I mentioned that there is logging of ballots. So there's also, for instance, if you are someone who shows up at a polling place on election day, and you had requested a mail ballot, that information will be known at your polling place. And depending on the office, depending on the jurisdiction, you may be issued a provisional ballot, which will only count if, in fact, there's no mail ballot that was also turned in to that election office in your name. Or they will cancel that mail ballot, allow you to vote a regular ballot. And that way, if for some reason a ballot turns up, it is not counted. So those are the types of rules and procedures sort of on the front end. But then also, there's a lot of work that's done to reconcile the books, essentially. So through the post-election, the post you know, the certification process, the reviews, local election officials have to account for every voter who requested a ballot, all the number of ballots that came in. And if there are any discrepancies prior to that vote being certified, there has to be an explanation. So if there were, you know, multiple canceled ballots, that would all be accounted for. And so that's why we went to the local election officials, the local jurisdictions, because they're the ones that are closest to this. They have to explain any any discrepancies. And so that is why we went to them. And that is how we were able to come up with these numbers in terms of potential voter fraud. And of course, you know, through the course of reporting, we determined and we saw numerous examples, for instance, in Georgia, of the 64 potential cases, 31 of them were identified as administrative errors or mistakes.
I want to key in on one story that got attention when it first came out in Nevada. A Las Vegas businessman named Donald Kirk Hartle claiming that to his late wife, someone had voted her name illegally. How did that story end up resolving?
Well, so yes, that that businessman from Las Vegas. So he had been one of those who initially raised the flag in concern in Nevada that double votes. He had reported that his wife, who had been dead, had a ballot had shown up in her name, and he, you know, raised concerns about that. After an investigation, that gentleman was charged with submitting a false ballot, and that case was resolved. His lawyer said that he had taken responsibility for his actions for submitting that ballot on behalf of his dead wife.
You talked to, or the AP talked to, former President Trump as part of this piece. How did he respond to your findings?
I did. I did speak with President Trump prior to publication. We wanted to have an opportunity to talk with him and to hear from him. And as I told you at the beginning of our conversation, you know, I told him that, you know, we've been looking for voter fraud, and this is what we found. And his response was to repeat a lot of the claims that have been made, the false claims regarding various instances across the country that he described as suspicious, but have been explained by election officials. And so, you know, he told us that there would be a report that would be coming out, but he declined to tell us who was conducting this report. And he essentially said that, you know, he thought we were being foolish by, you know, publishing what he described as such a low number, because he believes still that voter fraud is and was much more widespread in the 2020 election.
Christina, we'll leave it there. Thanks for sharing this with us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Christina Cassidy, reporter for the AP's state government team, with us today to talk about their investigation into possible instances of voter fraud in battleground states during the 2020 election. They found fewer than 475 total cases of potential fraud across six states. President Biden won those six states by more than 310,000 votes collectively. Tomorrow on Central Time, tax season is on the way. The pandemic slowed things down for the IRS last year. What could things look like this time around? We'll get the latest tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll take a look at America's most broken law, speeding, and the reasons we do it, the cost of going too fast, and the efforts to get us to slow down. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.